Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Enjoy!
Thanks.
Order breakfast at the McDonald's drive-thru. Tell yourself you'll wait to eat it at work, but it smells way too good. So you eat it right there in the McDonald's parking lot meal. There's a meal for every morning at McDonald's.
Right now, get any size iced coffee for 99 cents until 11 a.m. and pair it with your favorite breakfast sandwich or one of our tasty bakery treats. Price and participation may vary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. McDonald's. I'm loving it.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Hello, my name is Dave Hanratty and there will be no encore. Welcome to a special episode of the No Encore Music Podcast in which we are joined by David Balfe, also known as For Those I Love, for an in-depth conversation following the long-awaited release of his self-titled debut album. An album I think anyone listening will agree is a very powerful, thought-provoking, electric, beautifully affecting piece of work. I say long-awaited release, but really, for so many people, For Those I Love is a re-release, the re-emergence of a project that surfaced quietly in the summer of 2019. There was no major PR campaign then to speak of, just a few emails sent around, and word of mouth building, a couple of posts on the likes of District Magazine and Nile 9. If I recall correctly, I saw a pop-up on District, and then on a couple of Twitter accounts, I think Nilo among them, and someone I used to work with sent me a DM as well, saying that this was her friend's project and I should really check it out. By that point, I actually had. I was initially drawn in by the stark cover art and the name. I figured For Those I Love would be a hardcore band or something, maybe in the vein of Converge, which would be great, but it was, of course, something different, which was also great. This album hit me like a bolt of lightning. It felt like something I'd never really heard before, at least certainly not from an Irish musician. There was alchemy here. It blew me away. It stayed with me. And though it was intimately about people I'd previously never heard of before in my life, it listened to me. It kept me company. It gave me strength, despite the unflinching, devastating subject matter at the heart of it. And I knew I wasn't alone in this feeling. It felt like something special that should really be heard far and wide. I saw David Balfe shortly afterwards, sending him a WhatsApp message saying that I loved the album and I would love to interview him if he felt up to it, mindful that I was potentially asking a lot of him. He thought about it, said he would like to, and then we met up in the Workman's Club one day, where he spoke for about an hour. It felt like a therapy session, which I hope doesn't sound too trite, that's genuinely how it felt. At the time I was working in Joe.ie, and it turned out that he worked quite close by, so we started going for coffee around the corner on some lunchtimes. It took me a while during this to kind of get the piece where I wanted it to be. Eventually, I got to about 3,200 words I was happy with, and just around this time that I was going to try and convince my editor to allow for this word count and for the pretty-looking feature skin that we used on the website for long reads, all in the name of an underground artist he likely hadn't heard of, David Balf asked me something. He asked me if I would consider not publishing the interview after all. Why? Because the project was going offline, with plans for a re-release via a UK label he had just signed to. At the time, date unknown. Soon afterwards, the album vanished from streaming services without public explanation, and our interview, of course, never saw the light of day. In truth, I was gutted because of how excited I was to work on it in the first place and put it out there to people, and to be present for what I felt like was a really valuable and important story in Irish music, a developing story, clearly. At the same time, though, I'd like to think that Dave and I had become friends over those few months, and I was really happy for him, so it was a no-brainer to put it on ice. Plus, I figured we'd get another chance down the line. As you might expect, I've been waiting a long time to sit down with him again and discuss the project. I'm operating under the assumption that if you're listening to this intro that you're very familiar with For Those I Love, that you've heard the album, that you know the power that it has, and what the project stands for. Of course, much has been made about its standing as a tribute to David's departed best friend Paul Curran, an artist whose influence continues to be felt across his native Dublin and the rest of the country. It's an incredible work, even if you don't know the backstory, if you don't know the context. I think just hearing it, it has a physical feeling that will kind of run through you. It's an album that exists in an incredible state of duality, however. It serves as Balf's extremely raw and inventive attempt to honour Paul Curran and those who have impacted his life so strongly, while also perhaps seeking out some semblance of personal catharsis. But it is also a canvas for anybody who listens to it to project their own thoughts and emotions upon it. And it really does feel, despite all of us being locked down right now, that this album represents a true sense of communion. I think you can genuinely feel it in the air. All of which brings us to this conversation, recorded over Zoom, so with that in mind, please forgive the occasional background noise, including children walking past windows and making noise, because that's just life. This was recorded on Good Friday, as the sun blasted through the window. The album had been out at this point by exactly a week, so I think it was actually a really good time to catch up to him. On this episode, we speak about the chart battle with Justin Bieber for the Irish number one album, something I didn't think I would be putting into my intro with the return of this record, but it happened. And Dave's reaction to just, and I really do mean just, missing out on the top spot to Bieber. Again, surreal, right? We talk about finally releasing the album again, the huge reaction to it, the response from family and friends and strangers, and how he's dealing with all of this. Selling at the Olympia Theatre in a matter of hours or days or less. How and why the album went offline 2 years ago and what led to it returning now. We go behind the scenes of his Jules Holland, Other Voices and Tommy Tiernan performances, and we close by asking what the future might hold for the project. I want to thank Dave for his trust and his generosity and being so candid and open with this conversation. I hope people will get something from it. I know I certainly did, much like with the record. Finally, if this is your first time ever checking out No Encore to hear Dave, don't be a stranger. It's a weekly music podcast. Out every Friday, we cover music news, we review an album, and we have a top five signature countdown kind of face-off with my co-host Craig Fitzpatrick. For example, the most recent episode was top five Kanye West songs, and I think all of them were pretty great. So do check it out. Stay with us. As for this conversation, a couple of hours beforehand, the chart results came through, and that's roughly where we began. So here I am in conversation with David Balf for Those I Love on No Encore.
I have a love, and it never fades. From red garden sheds to watching lads on steads knocking heads. From the 2x2 fuck you punk stage to a warehouse rave with a bloke we met on the way dancing till day. I have a love, and it never fades. Full of plights and gripes like Achilles who loves fights like you did, right? Like we did twice. I love you beyond life. I have a love, and it never fades. You are God's son across the belly, remembered by pictures on your telly. Your body laying in its glow, surrounded by those you know, crying for your words and your soul. And that final loss of your glimmer of hope that we heard.
Delighted to finally be joined on No Encore by the one, the only, David Balf, aka For Those I Love. How the hell are you, man? It's good to see your face.
I am good, and I'm going to already fuck you up here, Dave. I've just come up with a theory as to why I might be so quiet on your end.
Okay.
I'm going to hit a button on this and see if something happens.
Are you going to blow my ears out? Okay, right, go for it.
Check. Does it make any difference at all?
Much the same.
Okay.
But this will all be like masterfully edited in post anyway. So Adam's going to make us sound like superstars, as he always does.
Do you want to redo your intro?
I'm okay with keeping it loose, you know. This is good. I'm talking to you on Good Friday. The sun is shining through my window, and this has been an interview that's been a long time in the making. So, you know what, I'm okay with having a couple of, like, it's kind of fraying at the edges, which is a good way to start, which is how I usually am. So, but yeah, we'll probably keep all this in, but nonetheless, I will say once again, because I am very, very happy to have you on the show. So welcome, like, welcome aboard, man. I haven't seen your face like this in a long time. We used to go for green tea together across the way from where we worked together, and then the world shut down. So it's been a long time coming to get the chance to kind of sit down with you again one-on-one, as we are doing so, of course, here via the wonderful medium of Zoom. So yeah, listen, you've had a crazy week. How are you feeling?
I feel tired. I feel tired, Dave. That's the main thing. I feel all right, admittedly a little bit disappointed. I think I just, you know, I just wrote a small piece about it there. And I acknowledge I definitely should not feel disappointed. What a terrible thing to feel disappointed about, you know, getting the second place in the album charts. But I'd be lying if I said I wasn't. I feel disappointed because my ma, you know, my family, my mates got so invested in the idea of getting this record that was made in my ma's shed to number one, and they just put crazy graft into it. And I don't know if I've seen them as elated and together since the start of the lockdown. You know, it's been such a isolating thing, and it has really pushed the limits on the structure of our traditional friendship, you know. And we've been desperate to try and find ways to bring it together, and I think that this has really done that. I've never seen my WhatsApp groups and my Zooms as vibrant, so I feel a little bit disappointed that after all that I couldn't take a home for them. I also, again, admittedly feel like I had no aspirations about this charting. I also don't really understand how the charts work. I don't think I certainly didn't beforehand. Any understanding I've had of it since has actually just made it more confusing. But I didn't understand how they worked. So I certainly didn't believe that we would be in the position to reach the charts at all. But as soon as we found out that we were, and we found out that it was this like battle between one and two, I have temporarily forgotten how competitive I am as a person. Like, I was going to say even over a game of pool, but I take pool very seriously. So, But yeah, I'm a very, very competitive person. I just don't think I've ever been competitive about the creative arts before. But this wasn't framed as a competition of the creative arts at all. It was just framed as a competition. And yeah, I just, yeah, going back to, you know, 20-year-old kickboxing, just being like, nah, I gotta win this. So yeah, I'm not going to lie to you about that. I think it'd be really easy to play cool and be like, oh man, it's not about that. But
yeah, you could do a magnanimous post-match interview thing, you know.
Bieber
deserved it, man. Didn't deserve it, fuck him. So my words, not yours. But like, in fairness, I mean, look, I believe the Irish charts, I read it earlier on, and I think it said there was 67 sales in the difference, which to me is like salt in the wound. I'm like, what, it was that close on this? Like, it would feel almost condescending for me to try and like contextualize this for you, because who am I to do so? But my takeaway from this is I haven't even listened to the album yet, man. I feel like that's not going to necessarily last. It's his like fifth or sixth album. It's a very different realm, a very different world. I think, you know, at the start of the week, seeing you kind of like those kind of headlines go up, it was just like, oh my God. And yeah, I guess from your point of view, it didn't matter that this was like the biggest pop superstar out there. It was just like, people are responding. This is a hell of a thing. It's in sight. I thought it was going to be number one. I was actually genuinely kind of shocked and quite good at when it wasn't, but I hope it hasn't changed what must have been a genuinely incredible week for you, because like I say, I'm speaking to you on the Friday after the album came out, so it's been like 7 days. Album comes out, it's something people have been waiting for a long time to resurface and to come out in this form. You sell out the Olympia Theatre days later with almost no trouble or time at all spent, and then this incredible side story. I mean, you said there a few minutes ago that you're tired. I'd be shocked if you weren't. I hope you've been sleeping okay.
I think that there's something else going on with the investment, you know, my personal investment in this idea around the chart battle. And look, the reality of it is I have been searching for ways not to think about the significance or emotional impact of re-releasing this record, which I don't necessarily feel ready for. You know, I wrote this first 3 years ago when I was not in a healthy frame of mind and I wasn't in a healthy space in my life. And since then, I've worked very intently to be able to get to a very healthy space. And I have succeeded in doing so. And I'm a lot better now than I was 3 years ago. So it's quite difficult to step backwards into those flames again and to revisit a lot of those old feelings and some of that burden and pain that was there when I wrote the record. So I feel like on the week that's in it, it's actually quite a relief to be able to just ignore that and channel the feelings into something that seems so, I don't know, benign, temporary or surface level. It's quite a nice cheat, you know. Fully admit that it's way easier to just allow yourself get caught up in the competition of it and not care and not reflect on what it might mean for you as a person to have to do battle with those feelings again and the weight and the guilt that comes with something like that. It's a really nice way to approach it in a non-emotional and really, really pragmatic manner. So how I've been doing this week is very, very void of feeling and emotion. You know, I haven't felt joyous. I haven't felt elated, but I also haven't felt, you know, depressed. I haven't felt the same sense of guilt that was there the lead up to the record. I haven't really felt a whole lot at all. I feel like due to how much focus there was and my willingness to ignore the traditional and just go along with this drive towards the, you know, the more fickle end with the charts, I didn't really get a chance to reflect on the significance of selling out the Olympia either, which seems quite alien to me as well. I don't know if I have, I don't know if I've understood in my own mind that that's a thing that has occurred. I kind of feel like it's somebody else that is playing that show. And, you know, when there's a whole team working, you know, yeah, it's a little easier to forget the, it's a little easier to forget the personal significance. I think it's going to take me a couple of weeks to fall into the afterglow of all this and be able to reflect back then and see where I'm actually at with all this and maybe feel the weight of it all then. I don't know. And I'm tired because, yeah, no, I barely have been sleeping, but I'm not much of a sleeper anyway, you know. I work my day job and then I do the music and then I, you know, you got your friends, you got your family to take care of, you got relationships to upkeep, and you got to cook the dinner. It's a lot to do.
Yeah, you know? Like you haven't fully embraced the superstar lifestyle just yet, you know. I mean, maybe give it a few months before, you know, you've got like all kinds of people just looking after you morning, noon, night in that way. I can't quite see Dave Balfe selling out though, you know. It doesn't make sense to me. I kind of feel like there'd be, I don't know, like it must be head spinning, man. Like you mentioned there, like selling at the Olympia Theatre, and you can't quite fathom it. I can't quite fathom it. I mean, this is like, this project surfaced a few years ago quietly, but it took on a life quite quickly. It was very much something that people were drawn to. And I remember talking to you about it, you know, like we sat down for an interview before. That interview never actually ran. We were kind of going for coffees, like I say, like kind of on work lunch breaks and stuff. And I was like, there's so much happening or could happen or maybe might not happen at all. And I just find it incredible in the best possible way that like my buddy just sold out the fucking Olympia Theatre. I don't understand it, but he did it. And I don't know. I mean, like, it's just like, where does it end? You know, I mean, like, it's, I flash back to you telling me, I mean, like, I don't know if we can talk a bit about, you know, the project kind of going offline and then coming back and that whole process. But
yeah, why not?
Well, I mean, like, I remember you told me, like, you were saying, like, you know, there was interest. And I remember you were kind of like, you know, you're like, oh, like, you're like, apparently I have to get an entertainment lawyer. And like, what the fuck is that? And then I was just like, this is crazy. And then you're like, I don't know. I think you were unsure. I think you were saying that you weren't sure if you wanted to do it, to pursue it. And then you took the chance. And obviously now, you know, the rest is history. But like, for people who had access to the first version of the album, and then one day it was gone. Obviously, we now know the full story to some degree, but can you shed any kind of background light on just what that process was like for you and how it has come to come back for like in this form?
Well, I think when I very first, when we did our first interview to get it, the one that that didn't air, it was probably a few weeks after I first put the project online. I put it on Bandcamp. And, you know, even just putting it up on Bandcamp took a lot of encouragement from friends and family. But I put it up and you were an early responder, you know. When we spoke then, there had been no interest or there was no aspirations either, you know. I was quite taken aback that people wanted to speak to me about the record in the first place. But I was also very moved that people wanted to hear the story about it and people wanted to connect with something that, you know, was made at such a small scale, but with such passion and drive. Yeah, I think I should just
be able to talk about this.
I just got an Instagram message and it was like, what's up, man? You know, do you want to have a phone call? And I was like, I don't know who this guy is. He's English, but I think I might have said no. I think I was like, I'm not interested. And I think I must go back and look, because I was thinking about this during the week. And I think he just pressed me a few more times. And then we just started having phone calls. And that's when I first spoke to you about it, I think, on the sly, having a coffee going, yeah, I think there's like some external interest here in this project. And you're right, I was really not interested. I think I took the phone calls first out of curiosity, because my friends and family were like, yeah, just see what they're on about. And that just started to sort of barrel roll. And they came over, they flew over, they spent a bit of time here. And we just did a bunch of meetings and talked it out an awful lot. And slowly but surely, I started to build up a sense of trust with their intentions and their approach to the project, because that's what was most paramount to me, you know, that it was something that was extremely delicate, but that could potentially be handled in a positive way. I'm not a naturally trusting person. I think I've been taught not to be, for better or for worse, I don't know. So it took quite a while for me to develop that trust with them, but I did, and I'm very grateful that I did, because I've had an incredible experience with them and I felt very cared for, which I think might be rare within the music industry, certainly from people that I've spoken to. I think it seems rare that people don't feel like they're being taken advantage of, or exploited in some way. But I feel very, very cared for. I feel very listened to and heard. But I also understand I'm 29. Like, it's hard to pull the wool over my eyes at this stage. I mean, you still can, but it's a lot harder. I'm not charmed by things the same way I was when I was in my early 20s, you know, or my late teens. I think if this had presented itself to me in my earlier days, it would be a lot easier to charm me with the high life, you know. But it just doesn't. It makes me uncomfortable. It makes me deeply uncomfortable. I feel like I don't belong, and it's not the way to my heart, you know. But it took a lot of talking with my friends and family to convince me to remain open to their requests to maybe run with the album and do something a bit bigger. And that's when it first went down. And it's kind of difficult at the time because I had to keep very quiet about that. And although the album didn't get a lot of traction at the time, it did have some people that connected with it in a very, very personal way. And I immediately felt the ripples of taking that record down when I first did, because I was pretty bombarded with requests for people to be able to continue to live with that album and in some ways even depend on it. So that was a very strange experience. And I hope people don't feel let down or wronged by that in any way. I hope people can see it for what it is, and that there is a, you know, that there is and there was potentially a drive to try and do something bigger, and that could affect the greater good a little bit more.
Can I ask how you found the process of waiting, and like how patient did you have to be in terms of it going down the first time and coming back now? Because even with release dates, like when I started getting some press releases from UK PRs, at first there was like a release date, then that was moved. It was supposed to come out in like December of last year. And I must say, whoever made the decision to move from December deserves a fucking raise, because as I've always said on the show, I think releasing music in December is always like, it's such a difficult time to do it. I think people are always kind of, their attention is elsewhere. And an album like this one, when I saw it was getting moved to like the first kind of few months of 2021, I was like, yeah, that makes a lot more sense to me. But yeah, I mean, like, I don't know how it is for you. I think if I was in your position, I wouldn't be able to stop telling people. So congratulations on your discipline the entire time.
I don't think I take pleasure in telling people about it though, because it just results in more questions, and that results in more pressure, more stress. So it's a lot easier for me to just keep my mouth shut and not say a thing, because I'm much happier in silence, I think, which has been a difficult thing then for the past couple of weeks, having to do loads of press obligations. It's taken me a while to become comfortable with that. How I felt about waiting though is, it's a complicated answer to give you. I mean, for the amount of potential release dates you've heard about, I've probably heard about a lot more. We went through many release dates and then cancelled them and then moved it again and moved it again. And I'm really happy that we did, for a number of reasons. Least of all is the fact that, as I stated earlier, you know, I am in such a healthier space now as a person, that although it makes me nervous to walk back, I am in a much more prepared state of mind to be able to walk back now And I think that that distance, although it has felt like I've carried part of that weight and that burden with me the whole time, I've gotten stronger as I've done it. So it's easier for me to turn back and face that now. So I'm quite glad overall that we had to wait as long as we did, because it has allowed me to feel more distanced from where I was 3 years ago, and also a little bit easier to speak about where I was at that time, because it feels like it has less, it has a little bit less significance to where I'm at right now. And it's a lot harder for the allure of the oblivion and intoxication at that time to drag me back, because I'm pretty grounded now, you know. I hope that makes some semblance of sense.
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, obviously, like, your perspective is going to be unique regardless, but the fact that there are multiple perspectives offering you their perspective throughout this process, I mean, like, whether it was when it first surfaced, or whether in this last kind of week or two, or maybe since the start of the year, or like when the project was officially announced that it was coming back late last year, if I could possibly bring you back to when we spoke a few years ago just for a second, because I just want to kind of quote something that you said to me at the time. I think I was asking you just about like people's reactions essentially, and you were saying that you've said for years it's something that you and Paul always harped on about, that Dublin is, quote, fucking tiny, which it is. You said everybody knows everybody. It's very hard to be in any way involved in any category of activity, not know your peers, and not know so much about their life. When I shared the record online, I assumed I'm sharing this with my friends, my peripheral friends, who maybe I haven't spoken to a lot in the past year. Hopefully this will give some insight into why that hasn't been the case, and also maybe friends of Paul's that might also find something in it that I found in it. I didn't necessarily understand or anticipate that I would be sharing it with a significantly wider audience than that, which was true at the time, but now it's so much bigger. You know, I mean, like, even like if you look back to, say, like the chart battle that we just talked about, you're seeing the likes of like Kojak, Dermot Kennedy, Kate Nash, others just like putting up Instagram stories and pushing you on, rallying around you. And of course, and I think you are someone who kind of lives a bit of an offline existence to a degree. I mean, you must be getting so many messages from people all the time. I can't imagine what that's like, but has anything kind of changed for you in this time? You've said that you've gotten yourself to a place where you're a bit more centered, perhaps, and hopefully that is healthier for you. But this project is so empathetic, and it is so, I think, for a lot of people, myself very much included, like, it strikes such a personal and unique chord with people that you're in a very unique position where, like, I hope that you're able to just completely distill that and not give too much of yourself. I've even seen you put up messages a couple of times this week saying that you've read everyone's messages, you're going to try and get back to people, you need time, you need space. And again, even like me talking to you right now, I'm like, you know, I'm one of those people who was kind of chasing you for an interview, and I'm like, oh fuck, you know, leave him alone, you know, and yet here I am. So I hope it's all right to even put this towards you.
No, it absolutely is. It is. And I'm very happy to be speaking to you. I'm also very happy that this is pretty much the bookend of the block of interviews that I have to do. And I think you understand how adamant I was about making sure that we did get to speak. There was a lot of like, no, I owe it to Dave. We have to find a big chunk of time.
I appreciate that, man. And in fairness, I think this is a good time to talk to you, given everything. Like, timing-wise, like, this is a fascinating time, so I'm glad that you took the time. Thanks.
Yeah, I've had to become comfortable being a lot more online, particularly this week, which has been something hard to adapt to. I've spent a couple of years sort of running away from a lot of the online stuff, but still understanding the necessity, or maybe it's just a perceived necessity for me, but the necessity to also exist online in order to exist in the real world at all. It seems it's what a weird time it is that we live in, you know. Like I was talking to you before this interview about feeling sort of cloud skeptic a lot of the time, and you know, feeling nervous trying to store some of my archives and my memories in the cloud. But it does feel like, you know, that world online now is possibly the only way to go ahead. And that's really, it's become very obvious over the course of the past year I have naturally become a lot more online over the course of the past year because it's been my only way to communicate with the outside world. I live quite isolated here and very, very, very rarely leave my house at all, just based on the circumstances of the world at the moment and some of the health of the people in the house here, who are very much in the high risk category. I have become a lot more accustomed with the online chatter in the online world, but it has been weird this week having to engage an awful lot more and trying to engage more as a way to show the appreciation and the love that I have for total strangers who have communicated with me and who have gone out of their way to try and support the record or what I'm doing or who maybe believe in what it can do. I feel some sense of obligation there to try and service that friendship and that relationship and try and nourish the communication between myself and strangers, particularly at the moment. And I know that that's not something that I can maintain long term, because I don't think I can do it to myself, certainly just to deal with the amount of time. I know I referenced earlier like how difficult it is just to feel very dedicated to keeping my main job. I want to keep music as something that is a reward and not something that is explicitly just labor that I need to engage with in order to stay financially stable. It is difficult because I am keeping this sort of regular job, which goes long beyond 9 to 5, and juggle that alongside my music and juggle that alongside all of the visual work and juggle that alongside the relationships and the family and everything that everything I referenced already. When you add the engagement with it still feels weird saying a fan base. I haven't wrapped my head around that yet, because I was about to say a fan base, but then I stopped myself because I feel like I shouldn't say a fan base or something like that, even though that's very clearly what is. You know what I mean? I feel like I shouldn't, because maybe that's that that Irish characteristic, you know, that a lot of us have, where we sort of deny the good in our own lives. If I'm just saying everything's grand, it's grand, like it could be brilliant, and I'm like, it's grand. Engaging with that fan base as well, just on that time basis alone, it's hard to do everything, and it feels like at times I do need to do everything. When you move past just those practical barriers, you get into the deeper thing that occurs, which is, you know, the weight of the communication that you get from others. The stuff I get from strangers is very overwhelming. It's very touching. It can be very stressful. It can be very beautiful. But that starts to play quite a dominant role in the day-to-day of your life, because you're listening, you're hearing so many people's deepest stories, their most dominant pain, just strangers from strangers, and it's many a day, you know, it's many a day. The private DM on Instagram, which is only something I've recently found out about since the, you know, since the first single. I don't think I even knew that was a thing beforehand, you know, but yeah, the emotional weight that you inherit from some of those is a very difficult thing to carry with you throughout your life and throughout your day to day. I understand that there's this like crazy responsibility that comes with being able to respond appropriately to those messages as well. It's not something that you can take in a lighthearted manner. I feel like I've had to speak to a lot of experts, and I feel like I've had to rely an awful lot on third parties in my life to know how to respond to some of those, because they can be very, very, very dark. Very touching, you know. And I understand in a lot of ways why people are responding to me like that, because it's such an open album. It's such a personal album. It's an album that speaks in names, you know. It very directly talks about people as if they're in the room with you. And so I'm sympathetic to how people would feel a kinship there and a desire to share some of these heavier weights that they carry. And in a lot of ways, I'm very glad that they do. But it is a weird thing to try and bring with you through your life. It's not something that I've really managed to separate from yet. And I think just by that nature as well, it's probably made me a lot more. It's made me a lot more online because I've had to engage more, but it has also probably driven me to want to be a lot less online,
which is totally understandable. I mean, I think ultimately the thing that like sticks out to me when it comes to this reaction to you, the word that comes to my mind is trust. I think that people trust you. I think that like you're not positing yourself as an authority figure or anything. You made this work and it's very clearly like so personal, so specific to specific people, but you created a world, and I think that people have responded to that world by wanting to join you in it and kind of, you know, obviously drawing parallels in their own life. And a lot of people who will listen to this will get something from it in terms of relatability, and will graft themselves on there. It's certainly how I reacted to it, and I know I'm not alone in that. I know that there are thousands of people who this album, you know, as heavy as it can be, it clearly has helped them and has lifted them. At the same time, though, I'm mindful of the fact that, you know, you might feel a sense of responsibility or something when it comes to getting those Instagram messages, which could be beautiful, you know, while also perhaps, you know, unfiltered descriptions of things and people and places. And you're in a tough position because like you don't want to shut them down, you don't want to ignore them, you don't want to be rude. But ultimately, I think a day is going to have to come when you have to try and dial that down, because that's not necessarily who you are. Like, you're not looking to pen a self-help book or anything. I mean, I think you made this very honest statement that people have responded to quite naturally. And in fairness, I think people would totally understand as well. Like, you know, I don't think anybody would anticipate not getting a message or not hearing back from you. I think people know and understand right now that this has taken off. You're a busy guy and you've given a lot of yourself. So, you know, I just hope that you're able to kind of turn that tap off when you need to.
I feel like I was better at that. I feel like I was better at that a couple months ago. But like I mentioned before, I feel like my sense of obligation, I feel like it feels like it's growing. And yeah, I hope I can move away from that in a healthy way over the next couple of weeks to months. And I do agree that people very much will understand it. I guess it's something I need to close off from myself as well. You're right that it's not sustainable. It's not sustainable, least of all, because I certainly don't have the answers. It's not, I spent so much of the past couple of years trying to understand what leads to some of the more tragic outcomes that my friends, myself, and my family have experienced. I felt a sense of responsibility there, very much so. I think I've written enough about it, but I feel like, you know, there's been many times in the past where, you know, I look back on it and I feel like, yeah, I probably dropped the ball, you know. There's things I should have seen that I didn't. And I mean, I've dedicated a lot of my time to trying to read every text, listen to every expert, try and study as much as I can to find not just the answers for the why, but the answers for the, you know, the answers for the how to stop it or how to support them. I'm not sure if my understanding is any more clear than it was. In some ways, it feels like I've just exposed myself to more questions. And if anything, that really speaks to the complexity of these issues. And it is very complex, and it's made these interviews, not this one in particular, because I feel like we're just kind of talking through everything, but there's been some interviews where people are asking very direct questions, like, why do you think we've had a suicide epidemic in Ireland during the late 90s or something? And I'm like, oof, okay.
How do you even begin to answer that? Yeah, that's...
I can try, but we might need a couple of hours here, and I'm going to have to start getting some texts out to try and reference them, you know what I mean? I don't have the academic support here but my point with these is that, you know, I understand how complex these issues are, and with that I understand how a one shoe fits all answer is just not acceptable going back to people, you know. The communication I receive, you know, it warrants responses on a one-to-one basis, and it warrants an engagement that's very specific and tailored to make sure that the right answer is given, or the most responsible answer is given, or the one that that can, you know, identify the best supports there. And I don't know how to make that sustainable yet. You know, I don't know how to necessarily bring people to the right river to drink from. Because I don't know what the right one is, even with all the support and the, you know, the excellent experts in the field or whatever that I've been privileged enough to be able to speak to over the past year, you know.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be on you necessarily to be that person to lead people that way, unless it was something that you sat down one day and, you know, decided I'm gonna be that guy. Which again, I mean, like, good luck to you if that ever happens, but that's not what you're doing with this project. And, you know, I guess it's you mentioned like the nature of Irishness earlier on and saying everything is grand. I think, you know, there is a incredible reaction that you can have, good or bad, where like you just kind of, not that you're overly familiar, but like, you know, you're just kind of like, that guy gets it, that girl gets it, they get me, and like, maybe that's a thing. I should say, by the way, sorry if I can just sidetrack for one quick second, given that, of course, you know, we are recording this in our respective homes, a bunch of kids just walked by playing basketball a few minutes ago, so I don't know if that's going to be on the audio. I desperately hope it won't be, but I was just like, cool, good stuff, guys, shoot them hoops, all good. But sometimes you're just like, oh fuck, but I'm sure it's totally fine.
That's pretty decent timing, because I had there's a bunch of kids that went by my window with Nerf guns. I think you might have seen. That's why I was looking out the window. And they're all shouting and shit out. They're out there basically every day and they always try and shoot me with it when I come outside.
Incredible. Like, I love how both of us are having this like incredibly serious conversation.
Yeah.
It's like, these are signs that are like, get out in the sun, lads.
Yeah.
But in fairness, I think like if I can say that, like, you know, I interviewed you there a few years ago, you know, we became friends afterwards. And, you know, it's like, it's funny because like once you do disappear offline, I know I'm going to miss your kind of clap emoji responses that I get to my Letterboxd film reviews that I put up, because it's like my favorite part of the week. I love that. I'm like, oh, class. You know, he thinks it's cool too. It's good.
Yeah.
But the whole point, and even now, like, I mean, looking at you down the Zoom lens here, it's like, when I think of you, like, I think of a big fucking smile. Like, you know, I think Dave Balfe, like, has that in him. You've got a radiance about you. And I hope that people aren't getting too bogged down in perhaps a picture of something, you know, that is just exclusively one thing. And I mean, I think back to, for example, and like, this is like a tough place for a music journalist to be, because I think back to like the Guardian article about you at the start of the year, and the headline was Ireland's new poet of grief, potent new poet of grief. And it's like, the music journalist in me that like can't resist purple prose is absolutely like, yeah, that's a great headline. And it's, I mean, I'm going to write a piece on this interview for Clash magazine, and I'm sure I'm going to stray into the world of, you know, $10 sentences, as I always fucking do, man. But at the same time, I'm like, that is such a heavy tag to put on anybody, let alone this guy. So I don't know how much attention you pay to your own press, but again, I just hope that you're able to kind of contextualize these things, because they're just huge, huge things. I mean, I don't know. I don't even have a question here, you know?
No, but you're talking about a pretty interesting thing. What I would say is that I very much understand the value of a headline. And I do understand that people, you know, everybody is fighting for digital clicks. I understand that there's a... that there is for many people a necessity to write with a sensationalist tone. But yeah, I mean, I would also agree there's a hell of a lot more to me than just being this harbinger of doom. You know, I haven't felt like that in quite a while. I used to feel like I brought a black cloud into a room, but I wasn't in a great spot then, you know what I mean? I don't feel like that now. I don't think my friends or my partner would think that either. In fact, I think my partner always gives out to me for being too enthusiastic after like 10 or 11 PM, where I'm like, you know, I want to go running, and I want to work out, and I want to play old PlayStation games at the same time, but I also want to like get a list of like terrible old dad jokes and like be like, let's figure out what the funniest dad joke is, you know. I'm in a good spot.
That's gonna be the entire kind of, I guess, blueprint for the next album, right? That's where you're gonna go.
No, that's gonna be the targeted headline for this Clash piece is
reinventing the dad joke.
I can do it, man.
I'm happy to set to work on that and change the complexion a bit. Yeah, just like kind of like just slightly get in there and be like, my editor will be like, sorry, what? And I'm like, I'm telling you, he's done it.
Yeah,
I've seen it happen. So yeah, you mentioned video games there for a second, but like, because like this has been driving me crazy. I mean, you've been very generous with like the back of the vinyl has like a list of all the samples. I know Nylar 9 has done like an article on that if anyone wants to go look. And I'm sure the clearance of samples was a huge deal in terms of getting this record back out. But like, there's, I think it's on Top Scheme. There's something that I don't know what it's from. I think it's yours. I don't think it is a sample, but like it is the most bubble bobble sound effect of all time. Like I just think back to arcade machines when I was a kid. It's got that kind of high pitched like pinball thing going on, and it's like it's a fairly constant refrain in it. But every time I hear it, I'm just like, I'm brought back to a childhood arcade, and I'm just like, you know, waiting to put like 50p in the fucking slot and play this ridiculous top scroll game thing. So yeah, that's where I go when I listen to the album anyway. So just in case you were wondering.
Interesting. Yeah. I've never heard anybody respond to Top Scheme as bringing them back to the Plex or something like that, but totally, totally on board with that. I don't know exactly what sound you're talking about, but it probably is a weird manufactured synth sound that I made. Top Scheme is almost explicitly like weird clangy synth sounds that I made over time and sourced all together for that one. I'm not a big video game person in general, so I'm not going to do a burial. Like, I'm not going to have the Metal Gear Solid samples or anything like that.
But it would be so good, man.
I have been replaying the PlayStation 1 version of Tony Hawk's 3. I've had it in my mind that maybe I might try and learn how to speed run it, because I can finish it start to finish 100% goals in like pretty decent pace. I'm thinking maybe I should go down that avenue, but why would I need to invite something else into my life that I will need to dedicate mass amount of times to?
And it's just going to make you more and more wired, like, at this stage. Yeah. If you're not sleeping past 11 o'clock, you'd be up till fucking 3 at this point. And, like, you know, you're 29, you're still in your 20s. I've unfortunately gone past that milestone. I'm a bit older than you. So it doesn't, you know, like the last thing, you know, like, I need is less sleep. I don't sleep very well either. Never really have. Can I ask you, by the way, I mean, like, obviously, like, this whole run, this whole project, this whole thing, I know that there might be a reluctance to kind of, you know, I mean, like, maybe me saying a reluctance to celebrate is a bit too black and white, but, like, there obviously have been very important milestones of your own along the way. Like, can you talk maybe a bit, like, Tommy Tiernan, like, appearing on his show and other voices? Like, these are huge things that I think you pulled off incredibly well and people really, really took to, but, I mean, it's got to be nerve-wracking, right?
Okay, so let's say from the start, the Jules performance, that's, like, that's the... That was such a weird time. You know, there was sort of on and off rumors for weeks or months leading into it that, like, oh, we might be asked to do a Jules performance here. We might be asked to do a Jules performance. And, you know, I had sent the label that email a year before or something like that. Pretty much at the start when we first started talking, saying, like, I'm not interested in being a professional musician. It's not where my heart lies. But I have two musical goals. I have two goals left in my life in general. And one of them is to play Jules Holland. And we don't need to get into the second one. I blacked it out when I posted it online. I keep it that way. I keep it private for now. I'll tell you off air, Dave. But
we're going to kill this interview right now so I can find out this wonderful, wonderful piece of music industry juice that I will never tell anybody else. But no, please continue.
And then we got it. And it was one of the first times where I've ever, like, freaked out about an external thing. Like, I got back to signing the deal with the label, and just how, like, anticlimactic that was. It was supposed to be, like, this big thing, and, you know, I just kind of signed it, and I was like, yeah, all right, cool. Like, they're like, we have a drink, and I was like, oh, I'll take a coffee, I think, like, I don't know, might go for a run over here. And yeah, just all of the moments leading up towards the Jules thing were stuff that other people were celebrating and I wasn't, because I just think, as I said, like, you know, I wasn't very charmed by it, because I think I have peered behind the curtain many times, you know what I mean? I've seen the ugliness of how these things run with many of my other peers who have walked this road before, you know? But then the Jules thing came and I was like, oh my God, this is a special moment. And I started to get a little bit panicked. And then, you know, I did my rehearsals and stuff, but then I turned up on the day and it was just, like, so peaceful. It was so peaceful. I didn't feel any stress. I felt nothing but comfort. And I think I got lucky, because I've responded for years to the visual of that studio, you know? I feel like I know how many paces it is from one side to the other. I haven't never been in it because I've watched it so religiously. So then to go in and do it in Smock Alley instead and have no visual tropes, nothing that told me I was doing a Jules Holland performance, I think it kind of let me away with one, you know what I mean? I was able to go in and just stay very calm and peaceful about it and not become overwhelmed. Whereas if we weren't in the middle of a lockdown and I was going instead to the UK to do it, I'd been getting sick in the Jacks beforehand, probably.
You're like, this is where At The Drive-In played, man.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I kind of freak out with some of those things with studios and stuff. I remember one day years ago, doing a bit of a separate job in RTE, just doing a thing and walking by the RTE Sport, like the panel studio, and being like, ooh, and there being nobody around. And I went in with one of my friends and made somebody else record us do the, I'll tell you who wrote it. It was Rod Little. He's the chap that ran off and left his wife for a young one. So I'm like, there's like, seeing those studios, so evocative to me and reminds me so much of these like monumental, like visual experiences in my life. One of which is Eamon Dunphy doing that. But
that's everyone's life, you know.
Yeah. Exactly.
Fair question. Yeah.
Exactly.
Transcendent.
But if I had gone to the Jewel Studio, I would have probably freaked out. So I think I got away with one there. Well, Other Voices was very, very different. Similarly, I feel like I got away with one there too because I got to play my first full set, but I got to play it to essentially an empty room. I didn't have the added pressure of a crowd. That's not something I needed to navigate. How peculiar this is going to be that my very first experience with a crowd is going to be with the sold out Olympia. I should actually not think about that too much because
yeah,
I might
put
get
on the back burner for three or 4 or 5 months.
Yeah,
and, you know,
yeah.
We'll get there.
But the Other Voices, when I feel like, you know, I was very lucky that I got to do that to an empty room and I got to pace my way through it and not feel overwhelmed by seeing other people's visual response. That was a heavy night though. That was heavy going. Like, you know, coming when I came off stage, I remember coming off stage and I'm walking into like the side room, and for the first time in as long as I can remember, crying. Because I don't cry very often. In fact, I would have told people that I can't cry. And I was under the impression that I couldn't really cry because of the medication that I take. I find it very hard to feel a lot of things. I'm very glad that I take the medication. I don't mind feeling flat because it's way better than feeling how I used to feel. But I was under the impression that I just wasn't able to cry because music didn't do it for me anymore. Films didn't do it for me anymore. Things would happen in my life and I would feel things, but it wouldn't turn the tap, you know. But I remember walking off the stage and going into the room and just holding the flowers in my hand and that photo of Paul and I was just weeping, and I was hidden behind a bunch of chairs in a corner. But what I didn't realise is that there was a load of like jackets beside me as well, so there was people from the crew like coming in, not realizing that I was there, going to take their jacket, turning the corner and seeing me and like freaking out and being like, I'm so sorry. And like running off, and that just happening like every 2 minutes on repeat for about 15 minutes. I felt like it was actually probably pretty fitting. You know what I mean? It added enough comedy into it for me to find a little bit of a way out afterwards, you know what I mean? To know, this has happened too many times now, I got to stand up and get out of here, I got to go back to the hotel. Like, I remember walking outside then and seeing my dad. I came down with my dad, you know, and and hugging him and not realizing that there was, you know, the entire crew, the entire staff of Other Voices outside the church all looking at us. Maybe that hug with my dad was one of the first times again, and as long as I can remember, where I left the world that I was in for a minute and fell into something very, very different. And it was, I don't know if I have a very huggy relationship with my dad, so I won't ever forget that. I think it was a really important moment for me and my dad, and I think we've been so much easier to tell each other that we love each other now, you know what I mean? Those things, I'm very, very, very lucky that I got to do that with him.
I'm delighted to hear you say that. I think that it's, you know, that's an extremely personal, unique thing. I mean, maybe it's not true for everybody. I know I've got a similarly kind of tough emotional relationship with my own dad, and like, I love him to bits, but it hasn't always been manifested like that, like the way you just described. So, I mean, that's an amazing moment, and thank you for talking about it. That's really nice to hear.
Yeah, no problem. It's very universal, isn't it? You know, you grow up a little bit cold and you're like, damn. Still fighting against the tropes that were painted onto us as kids, the way we were told things to be. It's been pretty beautiful to be able to open that back up again, though, and very glad of that. You did ask about Tommy Tiernan, and one thing I would like to clear up, because people keep asking about it, I'm totally going to spoil the picture here. Legit, you don't, like, he doesn't know who's coming.
Okay, yeah, because this isn't speculation. The whole format of his show is that he allegedly has no idea who he's interviewing, but people are always like, surely he does.
No, and it was very awkward. My actual interview was probably about 90 minutes long, and they cut it down to much shorter. But I remember arriving and them like sneaking me into the building, and I was like, why are you sneaking me in? He's going to have no idea who I am. So like, we can't let him see you from a distance. I'm like, if he sees me from a distance, he's not going to go like, that's David Balfe there. He's going to be like, who's the unflit in the tracksuit? Like, he's just another guy that works here. Obviously, he doesn't know me. So, but yeah, it's like, man, it is high security. Like, it's really separated. And one of the thing, put me behind the curtain with it, but yeah, about 90 minute interview, had zero idea who I was, genuinely had no idea. So it was quite awkward trying to explain that, because I also have to like figure out how I explain who I am and what it is that I do, which is a hard thing. Mm-hmm. But they had to reshoot my reshoot my intro as well, because they first introduced me as David Ralph.
Oh wow.
Yeah. Very glad that didn't stick.
That could be your new thing, man.
Can't be.
Jazz only, you know?
yeah. The Duke Silver job from Parks and Rec. Maybe if I ever got it. My ma has always maintained that if she ever got another dog, she would name it Ralph. So it'd be Ralph Balf. I'm glad David Ralph didn't stick.
I will say, I mean, not to defend Tommy Tiernan too much here, because how dare he, but I will say this, right?
No, it wasn't him, it was the other guy, it was the MC that introduced me.
Oh, right,
because he gets a card in front of him, you know?
I guess more like the whole thing of like, if he didn't know who you were, it's like the whole format of that show is, I guess, it invites that. I mean, at least this wasn't like a Late Late Show Pat Kenny interviewing Pete Doherty thing from years ago. Pete Doherty literally turned around to him in the middle of the interview and said, you don't know who I am, do you? And Pat Kenny was like, no. It was like, great, good stuff.
I mean, it was the format of the show itself that charmed me to be comfortable with the idea of doing it. I mean, I have a lot of respect for that show. I think Tommy's a, I think Tommy's become a pretty great interviewer.
It's hugely popular. People love it, yeah.
What I will say as well is when we stopped rolling, he stayed seated in the chair, and so did I. And I think I got a good picture. I feel like he's got a good heart. I mean, it's a very, very brief off-camera interaction, but he was very concerned about, you know, how I was and how I was going to be going home by myself after having that kind of intense interaction for so long. And I have quite a bit of respect for that, to be able to do that after trying to cut all these like separate little promo bits after and be so focused on what is essentially your job. Like, that's your labor, that's your job, to be able to kind of come back in, you know, come back down to earth and back into the room and be like, all right, yeah, cool, that's done, but I'm actually pretty concerned, like, how are you doing here? And kind of just told everybody to leave for a minute, you know, and just yeah, I respected that quite a lot. I know myself, just in regular day-to-day work, sometimes it's hard to separate just in your job and realize that there's, you know, it's a whole human element. It's a whole human element as well. So yeah, it was a really strange experience, but I was charmed by the format, and I was also very touched by how caring the, not just Tommy, but also the staff were. I think I've always been told that the television is pretty cutthroat and can be quite, it's so fast paced, you know, you're just in and then you're out again. There wasn't any of that. There was a lot of like, here's the supports we have, here's what we can do, you know, if you need something in a day, if you need something in 2 days, if you need to talk about where you're at in 3 days, you know, here's what we can do. Yeah, I'm glad about that sort of stuff, because it didn't sour. I feel nervous about doing a lot of these things, because I feel like they could really sour. They could really sour my patience with some of the more traditional modes of media that you need to engage with, you know. But I've been very, very lucky. I've also been very picky about, you know, I trust the gut. I always have trust in my gut, and I feel like, you know, the label, the two, specifically the two lads I deal with, trust their own guts as well, and I don't think it's really steered us wrong too many times yet. So those things are, they're valuable. I feel like we've had a good picture of what way things can be, because I think we've said yes to the right stuff, and no, we've said no to the right stuff as well.
Well, I mean, once again, thank you for saying yes to this, and it'll be probably another 2 years before I track you down for another one of these. But in closing, I'm reluctant to ask you about the future of this project. It might be something that you couldn't even answer even if you wanted to, but I am curious about how you feel at this time about just making music, and kind of, because you strike me as like, you're a very creative guy. Mm. I can't envision a future in which you're not doing something, you know. So I'm just curious as to how, you know, maybe you've got a different perspective, or again, this could be something that you simply just cannot say out loud to me.
No, I can. I'll tell you about it. I'll tell you about it. I told you, Dave, you ask me something, I'm going to give you the answer. You know what I mean?
I'll tell you what his name was, you know?
Yeah. At the moment, I'm very visually focused. At the moment, I'm spending almost all of my time engaging with Cinema 4D and just building landscapes and worlds and scenes in cinema. And that's kind of where my interest lies just right now. And I wonder if part of the reason why I'm so interested in that right now is because how limited I am with moving picture at the minute, shooting film at the minute, because I can't really get out in the world and I can't really reflect the world that I'm in by shooting film the way I usually do. I would usually spend quite a bit of time outdoors and making a lot of moving picture that way. At the moment, I'm so drawn to fabricating these bizarre 3D worlds at the moment, because they're a way to kind of vicariously do what I used to do, just in a bit more of a surreal manner. It's quite nice to be able to. To enter into totally new landscapes at a time when you're so isolated to one office. When it comes down to actually writing music, though, I have intentions to do a second album. I started a second album. I started a second album with a very, very clear concept and a pretty decent understanding of the sound palette. I started to write some songs for it. And this was all sort of near the start of lockdown. It has become increasingly more hard to write over the past couple of months. Sure, there's been a lot less time to engage with that part, but I think really I have found myself out of practice with the tools of my trade, and the tools is storytelling. My practice is so much spending time with my friends or spending time in pubs. I know it's not the healthiest thing. It doesn't sound that healthy. And at one stage it was a very unhealthy thing for me to do, but I did get quite a good grasp on it eventually, and I was able to kind of do it in a healthier way. I got to pubs by myself an awful lot. I like to, it works well for me, and I'll often meet strangers and I have a couple of pints and talk to them, and when you meet a stranger in a pub, so much of it is about storytelling. You listen to their stories, they ask you about yours, and oftentimes they ask you things about your life that you've forgotten about, and you go back and you explore them. I feel like that's where my road running is. That's where I put the miles down. And I'm just out of practice because I've had no option to do that. I've been stuck in this, essentially, bar a couple of, bar three windows. Jules, other voices and one video where I got to go out, get tested, do the thing, get tested again, isolate for 6 or 7 days alone, get tested again, and then come back to the house and be with my partner again. Outside of that, I've just literally, I have been basically just in this office for a year or thereabouts. So my practice, It's not functioning at the moment. I don't have my skills there. They're getting worse and worse. I can't write the same. I can't express the same. I'm not inspired the same way either. That's a key. I'm not inspired the same way. A lot of people saying write about being stuck in, that doesn't speak to me at all. It doesn't speak to me at all. And the project that I was writing, it was so indebted to storytelling, and so much of the way I write the story with this project was informing what way I was shaping some of the sonics as well. So while I've continued to make a lot of instrumental music, I don't really think it's that relevant to where I want this project to go, what direction I wanted to lead. Some of my practical music making skills are probably getting better, just from spending some time with it. But but I'm not creating the world that I intended to with this project, or the world that speaks to me most. So I'm hoping that when the world starts to get back on its feet, and I can slowly start to return to a life that I lived before, or a slightly different one, but still one that's inspiring, that I'll be able to continue with that project and get to the next phase, because I do want to continue, and I do want to get another record out, because I've realized that I have a lot more in me left to say that fits into the vocabulary I've put forward so far. I didn't think I did, but I do.
Well, man, that's awesome to hear. And I know that there's going to be a lot of people waiting patiently for that day to arrive. But in the meantime, you've gifted something very, very special to the world. And I'm not the first. I won't be the last. But thank you for it. And thank you very much for taking the time today to chat to me.
Thank you very much, Dave. I'm honored. And it was good crack.
Yeah, I hope so. I wasn't too. Yeah, it's kind of like I was like beforehand. I was like, oh fuck, it's finally happening. And I'm just like, because I've been building up to it for so long. Obviously, like the interview from ages ago. I'm just like, I want anyone who's listening to this to get to know you better, and myself in the process too. And hopefully that's somewhere where we got to. So,
but if you really want to, then you should have left in the part where I struggled for like 35 minutes at the start to set up enough microphones to make things actually work, and still managed to fuck it up. Yeah,
that's just for me. I'm keeping that in my own like archive, that's my little thing. But that was incredible. That was like the greatest struggle I've ever seen. How many microphones do you have?
It's so evidently cool. Not enough. So yeah.
Okay, well listen, for those I love, Dave Valve, thank you, man. Cheers.
Dave Hanratty. No Encore, thank you.
That was David Balfe, also known as For Those I Love, in conversation on No Encore. I want to thank you so much for listening to this episode. I want to thank Dave for taking the time, and like I said at the top of the show, for his honesty and for his generosity and for his trust, because he's an incredible guy. Like, he's just a fucking cool guy. He's a radiant guy. I hope that came across. It's a pleasure to listen to him. I often don't want to say anything, you know? But I hope it was a real conversation. Like, with these episodes in particular, with interviews, I just genuinely I just want to have a genuine conversation. It's tough. It's difficult. I'm mindful as well of the nature of this project, the sensitivity attached to it, and the roller coaster of emotions that David Balfe is clearly experiencing at the moment. But he's a very grounded guy, a hugely talented individual, and a generous, generous soul. And I'm absolutely delighted that he took the time and that we were able to put this episode together. So, like I say, if you've never heard No Encore before, stick with us. We do stuff like this all the time. We get to interview people in depth, and we also have our regular show every Friday. There's a lot more to what we do as well. There's a film offshoot. There's more coming. And yeah, thanks again to literally everybody involved. And with that in mind, if for some bizarre reason you haven't picked up the For Those Who Love album yet, or haven't really given it a go, now is the time. Check it all out. Thanks once again to everybody for listening. My name is Dave Hanratty. This has been No Encore. There will be No Encore. And we're back every single Friday.
This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Head Stuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.
Competition never waits. Take your gear on the go with a custom pack built to protect it. Because any place can be an arena. Game on. The Tumi Esports Capsule. Available on Tumi.com and select Tumi stores.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.